Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Martin, and welcome to Eastern Standard, produced by Dynamics Productions with support from the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky and the Appalachian Impact Fund, working together to promote community collaboration, economic development, and education by increasing charitable giving and philanthropic investments across communities in southeastern Kentucky. The Appalachian Regional Commission is out with its annual report, and it features this color-coded map indicating, by county, various levels of economic status. And it looks like a red bullseye of distress has been plastered over central Appalachia, with the highest unemployment rate, the lowest per capita income, and the highest poverty rate concentrated in Appalachian Kentucky. If you live in or grew up in and still have ties to the region, that map just sustains long-felt heartbreak. But some see it as a renewed call to action. So what does that look like today in 2019? Many ideas and solutions are percolating among people in Appalachian Kentucky, but some are playing out more noticeably in other rural areas of the country. That came up in a June conversation with geographic economist Mark Haggerty.
There is a trend that is emerging and we think is going to accelerate of people who grew up in rural places or people that are looking for a different kind of lifestyle that are eager to get out of cities. And if rural communities can offer them the kind of networks and institutions and relationships that they're looking for, there's a huge opportunity for rural communities to attract and retain businesses and families and reverse the trends that we've been seeing over the last decade or more.
Haggerty's observation brought to mind something of a theme taking shape from conversations on Eastern Standard and the voices of Sandy Curd of the Kentucky Promise Zone, the Kentucky League of Cities Tad Long, essayist Lenorme Manuel, and Jerry Roll of the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky.
I think that that's a reality that's dawning on some of these communities, that the cavalry is not coming. We're it.
And I think what you'll find when you come to Eastern Kentucky these days is there's a lot of forward thinking going on.
The real solution is for us to come up with the answers, for us to implement the answers, and for us to make our economy and our life, our region, the best that it can be. And it's not going to come from D.C., and it's not going to come from the state of Kentucky. It's up to us to do that.
People have this feeling that someone's going to come and rescue them. And while there are a lot of folks that certainly want to try to help do that, and I'm one of those, it is really up to the local community to solve its problems.
What I want is for Appalachia to stop waiting for somebody from outside to bring us a solution to our problems. We can't help the fact that a lot of our problems have originated outside of our homes and our communities. But we have the power within us. If we will stand up and look in the mirror and say, yes, I can do this, we can do this, and believe it, to bring together the Appalachians with the ideas, the Appalachians with the energy and the will to work, and the Appalachians who have money. And that's something a lot of people miss. We have quite a few people in Appalachia who are pretty well to do. And if we can get these three groups together, then we can accomplish just about anything.
So when we create those kinds of communities where there's arts and culture and history that we're proud of and that we can own and acknowledge and become a place where people want to live, those are the things we want to focus on.
So we're going to continue to follow this thread, and in the belief that it can't hurt to listen to and learn from how others are experiencing it, explore how this movement from urban to rural and this do-it-yourself ethic are playing out across the country. Madeline Moore notes this trend in a piece she wrote for the Daily Yonder. It's titled, A Millennial and Friends Rethink Rural. Madeline is, in fact, founder of RethinkingRural.org, and she joins us from Washington State. Greetings, Madeline.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And first, if you would, tell our listeners exactly where you are.
Yeah, so I live in a small fishing community of about 450 people in Chinook, Washington, which is the southwest corner of the state where the Columbia River meets the Pacific Ocean. It's the base of a 20-mile sand spit called the Long Beach Peninsula that includes about 10 communities spread over that little skinny sand spit.
Okay, in your Daily Yonder piece, you begin by citing four things that you were told while growing up in the rural town of Iwako. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
That is correct, yes.
Okay, and the population now maybe nudging 1,000 or so.
Yeah, Iwako.
Okay, four things that I'm pretty sure ring familiar to most of us who grew up in small rural towns across the country. What were those four things that you often heard?
Yeah, well, the main one was, graduate high school, go on to college, be successful, and then if you're successful, never come back, or you probably won't come back. And if you do come back, you're probably just coming back to visit family. But that success was really measured in whether you left and moved off and did something else and didn't come back to the rural community that you grew up in.
So you did all those things, but then you also returned, and people thought something might have been wrong with you for wanting to come back. It kind of ran against the idea that success equals getting out and staying out for good. But you say that many millennials that you know are changing that narrative. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I think, I graduated college in the middle of the recession, and I quickly realized that my journalism degree was going to be pretty hard for me to find a typical 9-to-5 kind of career-driven job, and I didn't really want that anyway. And so after college, I decided to go travel abroad for a few months and work on organic farms, and then I came home and started a small farm with my now husband on my parents' property. And it just kind of worked out. He had a job back where we grew up. And so we decided to set some roots for a brief amount, what we thought would be a brief amount of time. And I decided to start a small bakery. And so that's kind of what brought us back to where I grew up. I think in terms of millennials and people deciding to move back to the rural places that they grew up in, or it really, like you said, is a different way of life. And I think a lot of us during the recession realized that kind of the typical rat race maybe wasn't what we wanted and wasn't going to lead to a lifestyle that was conducive to having a family or kind of things that seemed to mean a lot to this generation.
How long have you been back?
About 7 years, actually 8 years.
Okay. So that's a good long time. What sorts of services and amenities do you observe that a small community that's interested in attracting more young adults like you and your husband, what could they offer in the way of building a lifestyle that urban areas can't?
Yeah, I think there's definitely a sense of community that pops up around things like food and outdoor recreation. We live in a really gorgeous place, as you might imagine. And so there's so much to offer in terms of hikes and beaches and being outside and being more connected to nature and the land. Also having access to property that you can have a small farm on or even just a small garden. Also, I think small business plays such a key role in rural communities and also attracting and keeping young people and young families within those communities. We can be seen multiple days a week at a couple of our favorite local restaurants and our brewery. My husband works part-time at the local distillery. So I think small business is really key to that as well.
Do you notice something of a chicken and egg dynamic going on? The community needs to develop these amenities and these services to increase its tax base, but lacks the tax base to make the investments needed to make those improvements. Is that going on in your area?
Yeah, to some degree, although I think the people that have decided to dig in are just going to do that innately because they feel like it's the right thing to do. And a lot of the people that are digging in and starting those small businesses are a new, younger generation that's kind of recently moved back. And they're deciding to do things in a different way than maybe has been done in the last one or two decades.
So speaking generally now about rural communities all over the country, what have you observed that you would recommend these communities avoid doing?
Yeah, that's a great one. So I think the idea of kind of overburdening, I mean, young people within rural still are kind of unicorns in a way. And so I think there's a lot of pressure on young people to be involved and be the savior of community organizations and community events. And there's kind of this constant drumbeat of, we want young people showing up to our board meetings, and why don't we have young people on our board? And that's great, but I think there also has to be this balance of allowing young people to find their way within rural and not trying to overburden them with these roles and feeling frustrated, especially when they don't participate in the way that's been expected of them. I think, for example, I have a year and a half year old, and while I am on a lot of boards, attending a board meeting that's maybe half an hour from my house once every 2 weeks is pretty difficult for me, having a full-time job and a child, and I'm not retired. And so thinking about ways that young people can engage in organizations and traditional boards and things like that in non-traditional ways, I think is really important and key to getting those voices at the table, but not getting frustrated when they can't give maybe the same level of commitment that someone who is retired and doesn't have a full-time job or young children can do.
So did those concerns and those issues lead to creating Rethinking Rural?
Yeah, it did, for sure. So really, Rethinking Rural came out of my desire to meet other young people who really cared deeply about rural and saw it as a part of their personal identity. And I knew that there had to be other people doing kind of the work that I was trying to do across the country. And so I thought if we could just get 100 young people, young rural millennials together and start talking, that a lot of really interesting things could happen. And our first symposium, which was in Port Townsend in March of 2018, we joke that it was a bit of a therapy session, because it really was all of these young people coming together and venting their frustrations, but also venting their kind of desire and their need for hope and their need for support in this really tough work that we're trying to do, and the trying to push the needle a little bit within these small communities.
In your commentary in the Daily Yonder about that event in 2018, you mentioned that it focused the conversation around why rural communities matter and what might be done to make them better. And of course, tell whoever that was hello.
that was my dog, Doolish.
Good boy. Of course, change is something that many resist, and better may be a subjective term and not necessarily what long-time residents prefer. Have you encountered that point of view?
Yeah, you know, I have not really. I've been actually pretty surprised at how supportive the older generation of rural leaders are in this context. I mean, I think that people do want to see a passing of the torch. And while passing of the torch is often can be uncomfortable and can be hard because you have to kind of let go. And I think that that is something that a lot of young people would identify with in small communities, that there is this kind of push and pull that, yes, we want you at our board meetings, but we don't necessarily want to take many of your ideas because we've been doing it this way for the last 40 years and that's worked okay. And so we're just going to keep up with that. So I think that, yes, maybe in actual practice, it is harder than kind of the ideology of like, yes, of course we want young people kind of taking the reins. And then in practice, it is a little bit more difficult.
I would think that dynamic would kind of sharpen your skills in the areas of communication and patience and just trying to move things along at a pace that works with everybody.
Exactly. And I think we talk a lot about having reverence and respect for the culture. And a how the diversity within rural has changed, and also where our rural, many of our rural communities have come from Indigenous communities. And so I think we do take a lot of that into consideration. We're not just trying to wipe the slate clean and move forward with all of these grand plans. I have are really key cultural pieces of rural are really important to the young people that are setting their roots there. I mean, little small community parades and traditional events that happen every year. It's not that young people just want to get rid of those things. It's that we want to have them develop and evolve into this next generation and work for new people within the community, not just people who have been there for 60 years.
You have another of these events planned for 2020, and it's closer to our neck of the woods. I think it's in Alabama. Is that correct? Could you tell us about it?
That's correct. Yeah, it's in Nauvoo, Alabama, which is about a little over an hour outside of Birmingham. And the way that our future symposiums will work is they're going to be hosted and led by former symposium participants. So we had a husband and wife couple from Nauvoo who run a retreat center and educational farm there. And so they were just incredibly engaged and inspiring at our first event, and we knew that we wanted to partner with them and bring the model and this network of millennials to their community at some point in the future. And so we did a four-year plan, and we did a bunch of interviews with participants, and we really landed on Nauvoo as kind of our next place that we're going to put our flag. And we are going to be primarily focusing around agriculture and education during that event. And then in 2021, we're doing an Indian Country Symposium that will be based in the Pacific Northwest. But we'll have a national focus on tribal youth and millennials within tribes.
Okay. Madeline Moore, founder of RethinkingRural.org, speaking with us from her home in Chinook, Washington. Thanks a lot, Madeline.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Coming up after the break, learning how to listen to the views and concerns of veterans, a conversation with Travis Martin, co-founder of EKU's First in the Nation Veteran Studies Program.
You know, it goes a little bit beyond saying thank you for your service, mm-hmm. because in my opinion, a lot of times that can begin and end a conversation before it starts. We get students who want to really have a deep understanding of vets and what they go through.
Later in the hour, Lexington's growing cider scene and four more distilleries added to the Kentucky Bourbon Trail. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Major support for WEKU is provided by the law firm Hicks & Funson and their attorneys Josh Hicks, Greg Funson, and Shannon Church. Hicks & Funson is a Central Kentucky law firm proud to support NPR member station WEKU and fact-based reporting. More information at 859-777-7000.
Would you like to listen again to this Eastern Standard or past episodes? Find them online at weku.fm or on the WEKU mobile app. Do you have a news tip, a comment, or a question for Eastern Standard? Leave a message at 859-622-WEKU. It might be featured on a future show. Now back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
They can often seem like parallel universes, civilian and military life. It's not unusual for there to be a gap in understanding between people who have served and those who have not had military experience, combat in particular. And that's one reason why Travis Martin and Brett Morris co-founded the Veterans Studies Program here at Eastern Kentucky University. Created in 2011, it was the first of its kind in the entire country. Thanks for joining us, Dr. Martin.
Thanks for having me.
So the EKU website describes veteran studies as a new and growing academic discipline that examines the identities, the cultures, and experiences of members of the U.S. Armed Forces. So tell us what has inspired you and Dr. Morris to come up with this program.
So looking back at the time, 2010, 2011, we had a lot of veterans returning from Iraq and Afghanistan. I myself have been back from Iraq for a few years, and EKU was, we had a lot of student veterans on campus, and we were actively engaging in what Dr. Brett Morris led, Operation Veteran Success, which was a series of initiatives designed to improve our services for vets. I started working for Dr. Morris that year and came up with the idea of a veteran studies program. I looked around and I saw women and gender studies, African and African-American studies, Irish studies, Jewish studies, all these different studies programs, but there was nothing really out there for veterans. And so I came up to him one day and I said, why don't we try to start one here at EKU? And being the great boss that he was, he said, go for it. And so whenever you think about, you know, when you hear Eastern being called a school of opportunity, I'm a prime example of that. Here I was. I wasn't a tenured professor. I wasn't a department chair or anything like that. I was a first-year graduate student working here at EKU part-time, and I had a good idea, and the people here let me run with it. And so our goal was to come up with a way to bring together academics from different disciplines, different perspectives, and create courses that would prepare students to interact, work with, serve veterans in the job force. And we divided that into three different categories of study: the relational, the cultural, and the institutional, with the relational being how veterans interact within their own subgroups and with others, and with the cultural being analyzing representations of veterans and things like literature, artwork, and film, and the institutional being studying how the military functions.
You've identified some goals there. Would it be fair to say that the ultimate goal is understanding?
Yeah. You know, it goes a little bit beyond saying thank you for your service, mm-hmm. because in my opinion, a lot of times that can begin and end a conversation before it starts. We get students who want to really have a deep understanding of vets and what they go through.
Who can sign up for this? Who can register?
Yeah, anyone who wants to sign up.
Those who have served, especially combat veterans, have shared an experience, or have a shared experience, I should say. And that would seem to remove some of the barriers to communicating amongst that group of people. But what about understanding between veterans and non-veterans, which is what I'm talking about now? Is there generally a gap that this program might help bridge?
Absolutely. And that's, you know, part of the why we needed this program, that we felt, you know, people were kind of talking across each other when they talked about military service. And when I said anyone can join, a lot of people think of this course, these courses, and they say, well, it's only for vets. But actually, the opposite's true. You know, we get veterans who come and they want to kind of contextualize their experiences and study them and learn more deeply about what they went through academic inquiry. But we also get non-veterans. We get spouses. We get brothers, sisters, and people with fathers and mothers in the military. We get people who want to work in the services sector for the Department of Veterans Affairs and kind of work as nurses, as mental health care professionals, things like that. And so when we get all these different people in the class, we get people from a variety of majors. We get people from a variety of backgrounds. We get veterans and non-veterans. And it's those interactions between vets and non-vets that I think are often some of the most rewarding experiences in the classes.
So let's get down into it in a granular way, if we could. What sorts of areas do you actually investigate or study in the program?
So the courses are often like broken down into modules, and each module will take like a disciplinary perspective. So let's give an example. Right now we're redesigning actually the course that's offered by eCampus, and it'll be available in fall 2019. And we have professors coming in from departments like history, sociology, English, recreational therapy. We have a nurse that works at the VA coming in. We have professors from all across campus coming in and giving us some basic tools and skills from their disciplines to apply to the study of vets. So what will happen then is we'll have these students kind of taking very different perspectives to approach the same issues. So you might examine, let's say, post-traumatic stress, which is a very popular thing to study these days because of the prevalence of post-traumatic stress representation in the media. So people come in and they want to understand, you know, what's real and what's fiction. And so we'll look at that. We'll look at examples in literature. We'll look at psychological research. We'll look at sociological research. And we'll just kind of try to dig deeper and get beyond the stereotypes and the kind of preconceptions that people bring with them.
I would think having all those disciplines at the table would make for some mighty interesting conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you were to come into one of our courses, you might find a history student debating with a nursing student about the different outcomes of returning from war after different periods like World War II and Iraq. You might find someone like an English major debating with a psychology major about what's going on in a particular war memoir. You'll get all these different perspectives and takes on things. And, you know, you'll have people that are, you know, there to learn. And you'll have people there to contextualize. Like I said, we have our non-veteran students who are there to kind of get a deeper understanding of what vets go through. We got vets themselves who are actually there to kind of share and try to integrate into society through kind of sharing what they've been through in the courses.
This sounds like something even larger. It sounds like a window on the world, really. I mean, we were talking about people who have had world experiences and experiences out there that have been very difficult and challenging, and others who have not been exposed to those kinds of experiences coming together, talking about some very prominent issues in the world.
Well, I mean, if you think about it, the military is a cross-section of all of American society. So, you know, odds are that everyone, you know, in the class knows someone who was in the military, has met someone, or will interact with someone in the workplace. And so when we're talking about these issues, it's very likely that they'll leave this class and they'll go out into the world and the knowledge they learn will be useful.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit about the faculty.
So the faculty, right now we have some really good people teaching our courses. I'll talk about a few. Peter Barris is one of our professors. He is a former dean up at the University of Kentucky and a Vietnam vet. And Peter writes pretty prolifically about veterans issues for places like the Herald Leader. Another is Professor Liz Rogers. She's a retired lieutenant colonel in the U.S. Army, and she is inching closer and closer to earning her Ph.D. in history. So we have people from different eras of service, and we have people from different disciplinary perspectives teaching.
This question probably doesn't even need to be asked, but I thought I would anyway. Is this pretty rewarding work for you?
Yeah, again and again, if you talk to vets about something they're looking for after life or after their life in the military, they'll say they want to find a way to keep serving. And so for me, this was an opportunity to kind of transition from my military background into my career in academia and kind of make those two worlds come together. And so it's my way to keep giving back to the people that I served with, the military community to help make me who I am, and also try to kind of contribute to the world and the scholarship of Eastern Kentucky University and, you know, other people that study these issues.
You can learn more about this program online at vetsstudies.eku.edu. The page includes links to foundational resources, too, that you can dig into. Dr. Travis Martin, co-founder of the Veteran Studies Program here at Eastern Kentucky University. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
And thank you for your service.
Thank you.
It's the 4th of July weekend, as good time as any to talk about mom and apple cider.
Yeah, when we say cider, we mean hard cider.
Where do they get all those apples? How is it made? What's the market like in Lexington? These questions, plus a bunch more for Tim and Greta Wright of Lexington's newest cidery, Wise Bird, and Kevin Compton and Tom Sturm of Pivot Brewery, where the arrival in town of another cider brewery is not viewed as a competitive threat.
The closer that we can get to Asheville in Lexington, where we have a robust community of small community-oriented producers, where we are actually driving people to visit our city here, I think the better it is for all of us.
And additions to the Kentucky Bourbon Trail Craft Tour. Coming up in just a moment, I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Major support for WEKU is provided by the law firm Hicks & Funson and their attorneys Josh Hicks, Greg Funson, and Shannon Church. Hicks & Funson is a Central Kentucky law firm proud to support NPR member station WEKU and fact-based reporting. More information at 859-777-7000.
Do you have a news tip, a comment, or a question for Eastern Standard? Leave a message at 859-522-WEKU. It could be featured in a future show. Would you like to listen again to this Eastern Standard or other past episodes? You can find them online at weku.fm or the WEKU mobile app. Now back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
Over the past few years, the number of hard cider breweries across the country has doubled from 400 to 800, according to the Cider Market, a business that keeps statistics on the cider industry. And craft cider seems to be going through what wine and beer went through years ago, people moving from drinking big brands to being more discerning, niche, sometimes downright persnickety. At CiderCon 2019 in Chicago, that's the industry's big annual convention, The market research firm Nielsen reported sales of cider grew faster than beer, wine, or spirits last year, continuing a decade-long trend. Sales totaled $44 million in 2008 and topped $500 million in 2018. Regional ciders have seen double-digit sales growth in recent years. Big cider makers still reign king, but they're losing that dominance. What's contributing to this divide? Big brand ciders tend to be chock full of sugars, while many craft ciders contain very little sugar, if any at all. As Americans become increasingly careful about their sugar consumption, craft cider is an attractive option. The Nielsen research shows that cider drinkers visit on-premise establishments more often than beer drinkers, and cider drinkers spend more money. Also, craft ciders can capitalize on growing consumer demand for smaller, more local products. Small cideries use a wide variety of local apples to make their products, resulting in a taste that is unique to a region or apple variety. All of this information bodes well for a budding hard cider scene that's gaining a toehold among the distilleries, the breweries, and wineries in and around Lexington. We talk with a pair of local cider brewers. First up, the latest arrivals to the scene, Tim and Greta Wright. They just opened Wise Bird Cider in the Distillery District. Tim and Greta, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
What distinguishes your heritage style cider? Why is it called that?
The United States Association of Cider Makers has really been at kind of the forefront of defining the cider category within craft beverages in the U.S., right? So when they say heritage, they mean cider made from apples that were grown traditionally for making cider. So these are apples that would be high in acid, high in tannin, and have a generally high level of sugar. And these are apples that you would consider spitters. You know, you bite into them and they taste so acidic and bitter that you don't want to eat them, but they make great cider. So like crab apples, generally speaking, Wixen crabs, Hyslop crabs, these make great ciders because they have a lot of acid, they're really dense with sugar, and they have good tannic component as well.
Have you found that you're able to source them around here, around the region?
We are sourcing our apples from a variety of family-owned orchards in Virginia, Pennsylvania, Ohio. But we're also working with Evans Orchard and Cider Mill in Georgetown. We're getting a number of apples from them this year to do a Commonwealth series product. So we originally had set out on this journey of making cider in Kentucky with the idea that we would source all of our apples from Kentucky orchards because there are some great orchards in the state that grow really great cider fruit. But those orchards tend to be pretty small, and the quantity that you need, one bushel of apples will get 3 to 4 gallons of cider. And if you're talking about making, you know, 100 gallons versus 10,000 gallons, the scale there gets a little bit out of what a lot of the orchards in-state can do. So we end up going out of state for some of those fruit.
You're located on the ground level of what used to be the Rick House for the Pepper Distillery in the Manchester Distillery District. And you open up onto Town Branch Creek, and you'll have the trail going by there pretty soon.
We do. We're so excited about that.
Yeah. So if you would just walk us through the front door, what's the experience like?
So as you walk through our front doors, you're immediately greeted by a mural painted by a company out of Louisville called Often Seen, Rarely Spoken. As you round the bend, you see another mural of a huge branch of apples, and it's just gorgeous. We really wanted our space to be light and airy, but also have some type of art in it. Our space was designed by Pole Rosa Pole, by Clive Pole and Jill Farfan, and we think we've done a really good job of having an open and inviting space, but also we wanted to stay true to the roots of the building. The building is an old brick house where alcohol was stored. We have soaring ceilings with huge posts to keep the whole building upright. So the posts have been whitewashed. You can still see the old numbers that have been stamped on those posts, which were used to guide people to where something was stored. We use a lot of wood from Kentucky. We've sourced that locally as well. We have wood from a Jim Beam plant. And you can see where they've rolled the barrels to create like these awesome old grooves into the wood. We have another, and our last mural is this massive owl, which kind of sneaks out at you from the very back of our space in one of our lounge areas. again, it's really a striking piece of art in an otherwise really light and bright but tame place. It's a very, I think, soothing place, especially when you look out the windows and you see the greenery that surrounds the Town Branch Creek.
So do you offer a variety of ciders?
Ultimately, by the end of this first year, we hope to have upwards of 8 products. And each of these ciders will showcase a different variety of apple or a different blend of apples or some sort of a highlight from a post-production standpoint. So we might take a cider that we've made and dry hop it so that we have a dry hop cider. We're working with Barrel House Distilling across the parking lot from us to do an apple brandy. So we have fermented a cider that they will distill into an apple brandy, and they'll keep half and do whatever they're going to do with it. I think probably just age an apple brandy in their barrels. And then we'll take half and fortify a cider similar to what the French would call a Pommeau, or in Normandy you would call Calvados, which is an apple brandy blended in with apple juice.
That collaboration is really interesting. How did that come about?
Pommeau is fairly common in the heritage cider world. And us being so close to our distilling neighbors, we have wanted to find a way to collaborate with them and collaborate with some of the breweries that are around us as well, Ethereal Infusion. So we've been exploring those conversations with them. And the Pommeau collaboration with Barrel House was just a really natural fit.
Are you going to be bottling your ciders?
We'll be bottling and kegging. So we'll have bottles. We'll have cider available in 750 milliliter and 500 milliliter bottles, as well as 32-ounce growlers in the tap room. So people that come to the tap room and want to have a glass or a flight of cider but then want to take a bottle home with them, we'll have that option. We're in discussions with a distributor right now, so hopefully in the next few months we'll have those details ironed out and our cider will be available outside of our tap room as well.
I was going to ask you if you're finding the market receptive. Have you had people come through your door yet?
We've had a lot of people come and poke their head in. Uh-huh. And we're members of the Kentucky Guild of Brewers. We're also members of the Kentucky Wineries Association because we kind of cross the divide between beer and wine. And we have felt that there has been an overwhelming interest for what we're doing. Our neighbors here in Lexington, Pivot and Country Boy, that have been making cider for a few years now, have really demonstrated that there is a strong interest in the market for a cider. And we're grateful to be a part of what they've already created and to come in and now have our focus on a traditional or a heritage style cider. It just gives the consumers another option for a cider in this area.
And so you're kind of hoping to grow the local palate for
cider. That's right. Right. The more people that know about cider and understand what a cider is, it's going to be great for everyone that is interested in or is currently making cider.
And our cider is going to be different. It's made a slightly different way than Pivot and Country Boy. So we feel like it's just rounding out the offering.
Tim and Greta Wright of Lexington's Wise Bird Cider, we thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you so much for having us, and we look forward to serving you some cider in the very near future.
I'll be there.
Thanks, Tom.
All right.
Tim and Greta mentioned Pivot Brewing, and if you go online to pivotbrewingcompany.com, the first image you see is iconic. Rosie the Riveter, wrench in hand, raised high above her head. What does that have to do with making hard cider? Kevin Compton and Tom Stern from Pivot Brewery are here, and they have the answer to that question. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, well, thank you for having us. Yeah, I really appreciate this.
And so why Rosie the Riveter?
Well, you know, I think it's an iconic image, and it captures really our mission out there. And it's a mission of just community, and providing a forum for people to come together and really push some progressive causes and help our local community here and hopefully one day help a larger community.
And so the business is wrapped around making hard cider, but you're more than that.
Well, it is. And, you know, it's wrapped around an old neighborhood pub feel. And I think the business of brewing beer and hard cider and serving those through your local pub lends itself to bringing people together and having good conversations. And I think at the root of solutions is good conversation. So that is it's kind of the base.
So tell us where we find Pivot Brewing. Where are you located?
The tap room itself is at 1400 Delaware Avenue, It's really near the Jif plant here in town on Winchester Avenue.
So let's talk about the cider that you make. How did you learn to make it, first of all? How did you come around to making hard cider?
Well, it's actually the first thing I ever brewed. I started brewing in the late 90s, and, you know, it is a lot of trial and error at that standpoint. I mean, I'm not formally trained. Thankfully, I have a wonderful brewer that has come on with us, and he is formally trained and is able to correct a lot of our mistakes. And has just developed over time into, I think, a unique set or portfolio of offerings that we have over there.
In high school in Moorhead, our chemistry teacher, senior chemistry teacher, teaching us the distillation process, showed us how to make Applejack.
Oh,
is that the same thing as hard cider?
It's one step removed. So you've distilled what we've made, basically. We've done the... We ferment the apple juice. It usually ends up around 6 to 7% alcohol by volume, and then that additional step of distilling it concentrates the alcohol to somewhere between 35% and 40% alcohol by volume.
Do you also produce a non-alcohol cider?
We're working on producing a non-alcoholic apple soda, really, but all these things take time.
Sure, So where do you source your apples?
So in season, we do everything we can with Kentucky apples. So we are Kentucky proud, and we're very proud to work with our local orchards, primarily through Boyd's Eckert's orchard out in Versailles. But we do buy from the others, and I'd like to keep that a part of our mission as long as possible. That tends to run out around the first of the year, and then we go up to Michigan to source.
Okay. Any particular varieties, and are any particular varieties better than others in terms of making cider?
Well, I think they definitely are, yeah. And that's, I think, one of the advantages that we have because we press on site is we're able to tailor our mix as best as we can, depending on the supplies. A cider that is made from... let's say a Fuji grown in Kentucky is going to be different even from a cider that's made with a Fuji grown in Michigan. I mean, at this point, you are in the realm of wines instead of beer. And we definitely have variations in climate and geography that have their influences on the finished product. And that's where some of the art comes into it, as opposed to the science, is trying to figure out, well, these apples are pretty good this year from here, and let's try to get a mix of 20% of this, 30 of that, and coming up with a good end product.
So I guess you have to be kind of flexible, and your production is determined by conditions like weather.
Oh, definitely. Very, very much so. Yeah. And I mean, we just spoke with one of our Kentucky growers a week ago about what our crop's looking like this year.
And what did they say?
Well, it's going to be a tough year, I think, in Kentucky.
How come? Because it's so wet?
The changes that we're experiencing right now.
How many varieties do you work with?
Well, generally, I'd say about 10, but it can be a little more.
It can be as many as 40. Boyd's grows over 40 varieties of apple.
Wow.
And kind of the interesting thing, not to step back, but the producing ciders here in the United States versus continental, where they're very popular in Europe, it was a very popular drink here until Prohibition. And then a lot of the orchards were cut down and burned to the ground. And so there was a huge rebranding effort on the parts of orchard. That's why cider in the United States is a soft cider, non-alcoholic beverage, whereas the alcoholic beverage is hard cider. The dessert apples make a different kind of cider, but one that we believe is equal in quality.
How are you finding the market? Because you mentioned that Prohibition kind of slammed the market for a lot of years, and hard cider has had to make a comeback in this country. How are you finding the market receptive?
Yes, and I would say that the best analogy I've heard is it's like the new wave of coffee shop. You expect to do a fair bit of education, People are not exposed to cider in the same way. And even talking about it, you know, it shares so many similarities with wine. You know, you're growing a fruit. It matters what ground that fruit is planted in. But we haven't gotten to that level in terms of cideries in the United States where you could say, oh, this fruit was produced in X state or something like that. I think it's possible further down the road, but we're not there yet. So a lot of what we get is people coming in, nah, I don't drink cider. Why don't you try it? We try to do a lot of events, which is a lot of fun, a lot of out in Eastern Kentucky, Northern and Central Kentucky, you know, and that's a lot of what we get. But the conversion rate from someone tasting our beverage to buying one of our beverages is over 90%.
If you become a hard cider aficionado, does it then translate into pairings with certain kinds of foods?
Absolutely. And we have done paired dinners. We enjoy doing paired dinners. We're always looking for those opportunities. The Silly Axe, which is a gluten-free restaurant, we're putting something together there in terms of pairing.
They're in Louisville, just to let your listeners know.
Okay, and that's Silly Axe. That's pretty clever.
Yeah, really. because cider is, you know, for those people who are sensitive to gluten, hard apple cider is a great alcoholic choice because it's naturally gluten-free. So,
tell us a little bit about the cider scene here in Lexington. I know that there are others in the business. Wisebird Cider just opened in the distillery district. There are other brands. Country Boy, West Sixth are in the space. Do you welcome competition?
Oh, I think we view it in a different manner. It's just a characteristic of our industry. A good analogy that I say is that the closer that we can get to Asheville in Lexington, where we have a robust community of small community-oriented producers, where we are actually driving people to visit our city here, I think the better it is for all of us. And when we have a problem, we call up a couple of the other breweries. If they know a solution, it's always given. Yeah.
Kevin Compton and Tom Stern from Pivot Brewery, thank you so much for taking time. We look forward to coming over and giving it a taste.
Oh, this was a pleasure, Tom. Really appreciate it.
You bet.
Ida, sweet as apple, sakwa whiter. Sweeter than all the...
Meanwhile, bourbon. There are now 20 distilleries along the Kentucky Bourbon Trail Craft Tour, stretching from Franklin in the south to Ludlow in the north of the state. Rhonda Miller has more on the latest additions.
The Kentucky Distillers Association has added 4 distilleries to the Kentucky Bourbon Trail Craft Tour, bringing the total to 20. One of those new members is Dueling Grounds Distillery in Franklin. Founding owner Mark Dottori talked with us about why being on the Bourbon Trail Craft Tour is important for his distillery.
Joining the Kentucky Bourbon Trail Craft Tour is significant to me for a couple of reasons. First off, it's kind of a recognition that we've reached a certain standard, that we're producing a product that is acceptable to a trade organization that governs the entire bourbon spectrum. And it's also a significant way of driving tourists into our site. There are people who come to Kentucky specifically to make a vacation out of doing the craft tour. And so for us to be on that, for them to find us, for us to participate in the marketing assets and things that the Distillers Association brings to the table is significant.
How long have you been in business and what level have you reached at this point that allowed you to be on this craft tour?
Sure. I got my license in 2013. I spent the first couple of years making very small batches, testing things, saving things, and ordering equipment. And we got everything finally in and set up in 2015. Some changes in the Kentucky laws in 2016 allowed us to open to the public and have a cocktail bar and event space and that sort of thing. And then we put our first bourbon out in December of last year, 2018.
And Mark, you are the southernmost point of the Kentucky Bourbon Trail Craft Tour. Do you think that's significant?
I think it's very significant that we are the southernmost distillery on the craft trail. We are the closest to Nashville, which generates an awful lot of tourism. I get a lot of people who come in who are staying in Nashville for the week and they wanted to touch base in Kentucky, maybe hit a Kentucky distillery, and we're the closest one.
How did you pick Franklin to live and work? And obviously you came into this craft distillery
as a second career.
Yeah.
How did that all come about?
I moved to Franklin in 1996. I fell in love with the town. I had been going up there and visiting a friend who lived in the area. I just loved the vibe of the place. And on Easter Sunday, 1996, I was taking a ride around through the country and I found like this farmhouse of my dreams. And so for the next several years, I spent my time commuting to Nashville because I was working in the Nashville music business on the business side. With the idea that eventually I wanted to start some kind of business in Franklin that would kick in as the music thing would inevitably start to fade, because that's the nature of that business, is you're not there forever. And so I looked for a long time. I tried a lot of different things. I tried little business ventures. I took a couple of jobs thinking that they might kind of pan out. And what I eventually found was, you know, I was already a beer brewer. I liked the idea of doing something in food. And probably the biggest thing, I wanted to hire local people, make a local product, and make, most importantly, a physical product, something that actually put across the table. I'd spent most of my life talking on the telephone to make a living, and I wanted to do something that was physical.
So how many employees do you have now?
There's three of us full-time, counting myself, part-time graphics person, and a part-time bartender and barback.
Do you see yourself expanding, or do you know yet?
Yeah, I do. The last 3 years that we've been really making product, I've doubled my production each year. When you take it in terms of the real numbers, that isn't very much. We went from 25 to 50 to 150 barrels this year. So to continue that growth, I will have to add equipment and I will have to do some expansion. And that's something that we're looking at right now. So we want to go from a 200-gallon system to an 800-gallon system, hopefully within 2 years.
Thanks, Mark.
Thank you.
We've been talking with Mark Dottori, owner of Dueling Grounds Distillery in Franklin. The other distilleries added to the Kentucky Bourbon Trail Craft Tour are Casey Jones in Hopkinsville, Boundary Oak in Radcliffe, and Second Sight in Northern Kentucky. In Bowling Green, I'm Rhonda Miller.
Before we go, we would like to acknowledge the generous support that's been provided by Alltech. By stepping up as Eastern Standard's first production sponsor, they made it possible to partner with Neil Kesterson at Lexington's Dynamics Productions. Neil has extensive experience working with NPR and brings to the table an understanding of professional public radio production values. With this addition, Eastern Standard Production is now supported by the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky and its Appalachian Impact Fund. These nonprofits are deeply engaged in the hard work of moving Eastern Kentucky from distressed to prosperous, and we're pleased to align with that mission. So heartfelt thanks to Alltech for a great year of support, and welcome to the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky and the Appalachian Impact Fund. That wraps this week's edition. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions with the support of the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky, an accredited community foundation, and their Appalachian Impact Fund. Our executive producer is Mike Savage. Neil Kesterson is our producing engineer and audio editor. You can listen to editions of Eastern Standard on the WEKU mobile app or as a podcast on NPR One, iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. We like to hear from you. Email us at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.